Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Media Network, a weekly review of what's happening in the international communications business, hosted by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and it's cooled off a bit now, but the last few days have been very warm indeed.
Yes, just the sort of weather to be outside doing the odd bit of household maintenance. I've just come in to present this week's show, and I see there's a backlog of correspondence building up. Please bear with us. We're getting to it as fast as we can. Some of the correspondence has been included in today's programme. But we start with Diana doing the impossible by boiling the kettle to make the tea in the Radio Netherlands Interactive Department.
And at the same time asking website editor Andy Sennett if he has any news for us.
Yes, Diana. First of all, Kai Ludwig in Germany informs us that Ostdeutscher Rundfunk Brandenburg will be making some special shortwave broadcasts in July. ORB is a public broadcaster for the German federal state of Brandenburg. Since 1993, it has only been using FM. But on the occasion of an event called the Berlin Love Parade, the ORB youth programme called Fritz will be carried on shortwave. Broadcast will be continuous for a 48-hour period, starting at 16 hours UTC on Friday the 7th of July, and ending at 16 hours UTC on Sunday the 9th of July. And they haven't announced a transmitter site, but presumably it'll be Jülich.
And will they be using more than one frequency?
Yes, the schedule's quite long, actually. Most of the transmissions will be beamed to Europe, but some will also be beamed to America, the Pacific and the Far East. And I'll put the full details on the Media Network website.
Yes, and there's a new, easy-to-remember URL for our website, I believe.
Yes, we've registered our own domain, so you can now access the site at www.medianetwork, all one word, .nl. That's www.medianetwork.nl, as well as via the Radio Netherlands homepage, as usual.
From Seoul, the capital of the Republic of Korea.
Now, Andy, following the recent summit meeting between the leaders of North and South Korea, I've seen reports that the two countries are going to tone down their verbal attacks on each other. Has that had any impact yet on the various shortwave stations that have been pumping out propaganda from both sides for many years?
Well, the answer is yes and no. The broadcasts are still on the air, but according to monitors who speak Korean, the content has been toned down. Of course, these are very early days yet, and after half a century of mutual hostility, I don't think we should expect things to change overnight. What has stopped is a barrage of insults carried over powerful loudspeakers on opposite sides of the demilitarized zone. That was always the crudest, most offensive type of propaganda, and it's easiest to stop. As for radio, there are still many obstacles to overcome as the two countries attempt to undo 50 years of mutual hate. It'll be interesting to see if there's any reduction in the activity of the number stations serving those who work in the espionage business in that part of the world. Now, that really would be an indication that things are changing for the better.
OK, Andy, and now to a strange tale from the UK about Euro 2000.
Yes, and I'm not talking about England's exit on Tuesday. This is about a piece of deception by the national commercial station Talk Sport. Euro 2000 radio commentary rights for the UK are held by BBC Radio 5 Live, but TalkSport is broadcasting commentaries anyway. What they've done is they've hired a studio in Amsterdam and put a TV set in it, so their commentators can sit in comfort and commentate on the TV pictures.
Well, good idea, which presumably hasn't gone down well at the BBC.
You bet. In fact, they applied for a court injunction, but the court was unable to act, since TalkSport is admitting on the programmes that it's not actually broadcasting from the stadium. And there's no law, it seems, to stop any radio station from airing someone's commentary on what he's watching on a television set.
But in that case, why doesn't this sort of thing happen more often?
Well, I think it probably does, Diana. The other day, our local paper here in Hilversum reported that one commentator for the domestic station NOS had done a broadcast live from his own front room while watching a TV set. The broadcasters say this only happens in extremely rare circumstances, but it does make you wonder whether all the things you hear are really what they seem.
And there was more bad news for the BBC on Tuesday evening, I hear.
Yes, there was a major power failure in West London that knocked out the television centre a few hours before live coverage of the England game was scheduled, and it also affected Radio 5 Live, which broadcast from there. The radio staff rushed the broadcasting house to get back on the air before the big match. Meanwhile, the staff at Television Centre had to be evacuated for safety reasons because the fire alarms weren't working. Then, just to make things worse, one of the standby generators caught fire.
So did they manage to broadcast the match?
Yes, they did, but not without a lot of irate calls from football fans who tuned in expecting to see pre-match build-up on the news and instead saw an old edition of the comedy Dad's Army.
Thanks, Andy. And while he enjoys his tea, we switch subjects because earlier this month we carried a comment from Scotland about the slow growth of digital audio broadcasting in Europe. A day later, a colour brochure arrived in the post from Roberts Radio in the UK. They're a British manufacturer that have a well-deserved reputation for innovation.
The leaflet explains the launch of the world's first DAB portable receiver, though it's immediately apparent that this is more of a transportable designed to be self-contained but not carried around on a daily basis.
Reason enough to call Roberts Radio Chief Executive Officer Leslie Burridge and ask him why the new set is so large. After all, other consumer audio compression technologies, such as Minidisc and MP3 players, can be powered with a couple of penlight batteries.
Current portable DAB products are large because the chipset that's required to drive the radio is very power hungry. And the three elements of the product design are disciplined by first the large battery, the lead acid battery, that is used to drive this chipset. And you'll get about 10, 11 hours life from that, then you have to recharge it, which indicates, of course, how power hungry it is. There are two large speakers in the product to obviously exploit the benefits of the improved sound. I mean, people talk about the difference between vinyl and CD. In my view, it's actually more impressive than that. And the other factor, of course, is that you do have a large display, the VGA display, which of course is an integral part of the magic of DAB, which gives you a great deal more information than you currently are able to pick up from analog products.
Burridge says that MP3 and other compression technologies may become part of the radio industry in the long term.
At the moment, there's a photo of the Roberts Classic 2000 DAB radio on our website. But can I buy one?
Well, you can if you're a very special person. We're only producing a few hundred at the moment, and they're going out on various researches and test programs and test projects and with broadcasters. The actual product availability is likely to improve around about September, and it is hoped that when we're starting to produce in greater volumes that the economies of scale will prevail, which means that the purchase price and the actual assembly costs will come down. The purchase price of the components and the assembly times will come down. And we are hoping that the retail price would be around about £500. Still a lot of money, but we are talking about that early stage in the product curve. We don't expect to sell many, many thousands. It will be possibly 2,000 or 3,000 in the course of the next year or two.
Which is quite low when BBC radio pamphlets claim that 12 million radio sets are sold in the UK alone on an annual basis. But all that is set to grow. At the Radio Academy last year, the UK broadcast industry showed figures saying that by the year 2010, 40% of radio listening in Europe will be on digital sets. Still, practical tests still need to be done.
We've got to check the strength of the signal here in the UK. We've got to ensure that the apparent coverage by the BBC and by the commercial stations is reliable. Certainly the evidence to date is that it is, but there are certainly large areas within the country that are questionable. In the case of telephones, cellular telephones, when we moved from analog to digital, many people said, I wish we'd stayed with analog because at least I was able to hang on to the signal. It's much the same with audio, that you've either got it or you haven't, but when you've got it, it's very, very good.
Roberts hopes that by 2002, an injected, moulded DAB portable radio will be on the market, smaller in size and with a price tag of around $300.
In Munich next week, a digital radio congress will show a study claiming that digital radio in Europe will have a volume of around $4.7 billion over the next 5 years. But many say that in order to achieve that, governments must announce dates when analog FM is to be switched off.
There is no date specified. I think as manufacturers, we would prefer that at least we had a goal to work towards. And in fact, I'm sure the consumer would, they would then have greater focus on these changes. I think we're some way off. And if you said to me, is it going to be more than 10 years? I would quickly say yes.
And that's unless government steps in with subsidies. But won't audio via the internet have grown to become a threat to DAB by then?
No, I think that's fringe. I'm not being dismissive of it, but it's we as manufacturers, and I think that one should recognise that we are the largest manufacturer of product in the UK. There are clearly going to be other developments linked with, as you've identified, the net. There's also the possibility of links with cellular phones, with digital phones. We're going to see an explosion, but it's going to be an explosion over a very long period of time. And our concentration is things radio-related, whether it's analogue or whether it's digital.
Now, the design of the Roberts Radio Classic 2000 is reflected in its name. Roberts started business in 1932. This DAB radio looks as though it could have been designed not long afterwards. Leslie Barrage says that's by design, not accident.
We had focus groups, a number of them, up and down the country, looking at the different designs. We had products that looked more like hi-fi tuners. We had products that were square. We had products that were rectangular. And ultimately, this one came out head and shoulders. And in fact, the view was that it was rather like some of the other design icons that we've developed in the past years, which are still with us. I mean, products that we developed back in the 1950s. We've reintroduced in here into the year 2000, and they are significant sellers in the UK market.
Finally, picking up from a point made by Philip Henderson of Bedford in the UK. Why has DAB taken so long? Transmitter networks are ready, but have the chip people on the receiving side done enough and fast enough?
I suppose the quick answer to that is no, but then equally we as manufacturers, hardware manufacturers, have been hesitant because we're not sure just how significant the growth will be. We've now, in the course of the last 6 months, learnt more about the program content from both the BBC as well as the commercial stations, as well as the local coverage. And I think that the excitement is such that we would believe that more manufacturers, stroke component manufacturers, will now begin to crank up the investment program in DAB.
We now go to London because the World Radio Network has been working on a hybrid of DAB in order to make more efficient use of the spectrum. Jeff Cohen is WRN's Director of Development and is coordinating the so-called PortaDAB project.
That's perfectly true. The Layer 2 system came out in 1990, so it's more than 10 years old. And if DAB was going to be developed today, it could use systems that had a much, much smaller data rate like DRM has. We're working on a system that will allow DAB to transmit MP3 streams, which is similar to the streams that you get on the internet.
The World DAB Forum has been adamant, though, that it is too late to change the MPEG-2 codec that is specified in the European Eureka 147 standard.
There is a specification for DAB, and anyone that wants to change it has to make a proposal to change it, and it has to be approved. But there is a way of doing it a slightly different way. The DAB allows independent streams of data for which you're allowed to support any application you like, whether it's web pages or images or any kind of data. Then there are questions about how you license that. Would a licensing body wish to license that in the same way it licenses a radio station? And that's a future question.
WRN got a grant from the British government to explore this further.
That's right. We got a grant from the British government for a project called PortaDAB to produce a portable DAB radio, and that's the radio that has been produced under the Roberts brand. And another part of the project was to demonstrate that MP3 streams could be transmitted over DAB. And we have demonstrated that now. The research team who have been carrying out the work at Loughborough University have shown that they can encode an MP3 stream and reproduce it through a laptop computer. The next stage will be to decode it in the radio itself. In a way, it's narrowcasting. It's very similar to the use of the internet for audio. But this would be a portable medium, and it's a way of greatly extending the versatility of DAB.
In contrast to the mobile phone technology, DAB is designed to reach a mass audience instantaneously. Remember, in a crisis, mobile phone networks just overload when too many callers pick up the phone to request the same information at exactly the same moment.
Jeff Cohen is cautiously optimistic about DAB, but he agrees that the industry has about 3 to 4 years to fix the cheap receiver problem. It's no good having transmitters provide 60% of Europe with DAB coverage in the next 5 years if there are no radios. And unless this changes, DAB will face a serious challenge from the mobile phone industry, who would love to take away DAB channels for their own use.
But it seems that from East Asia there's some good news about the receiver price.
Certainly, that's the reason that DAB is not taken off as a consumer medium. And there is great concern amongst the European broadcasters who've invested so much in the DAB transmitters. The most recent news was that Broadcast Asia in Singapore, a couple of Taiwanese manufacturers, were showing radios that were in the up to $150. The lowest sort of price they were talking about was less than $100. That's very encouraging news, and it shows that they have put a lot of resources into the development of the chips, which are the very expensive part in making this radio.
Jeff Kahn talking about DAB.
And now to another DAB, Douglas A. Boyd, professor at the Department of Communication at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, USA. Together with a colleague, Professor Boyd has just presented an academic paper at a conference in Acapulco, Mexico. The subject is World Space, and the study refers to claims that this organization has been making for several years. Let's hark back to the Towards 2000 conference held in Amsterdam in September 1995. Noah Samara, the head of WorldSpace, gave a presentation.
WorldSpace was founded in 1990 to implement a digital audio broadcasting service for the developing world. So our main target is the emerging markets of the world. Service is targeted to the 4 billion people living in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, Asia, the Caribbean, and so forth. It will come online, the service will, in the 1998 and 1999 time frames.
5 years on, the dream has been updated. The company website now claims the potential audience for World Space is now near 5 billion.
Together with Thomas Goldsby at Iowa State University, Douglas Boyd has been doing the mathematics.
World Space, correctly, and as you said in the beginning, advertises a potential audience of virtually everyone in the world except North America, which won't have access to the Latin American satellite. What we did was look at several factors, such as gross domestic product, the amount of goods of an electronic nature that are imported into Africa, North Africa, and the Middle East, in an area, looking at World Bank figures, of about 1.3 billion people. We came up with an estimate of about 1.57% would be in a position and possibly so motivated to buy WorldSpace receivers. And it's about 16.1 million people.
That's quite a difference.
It's quite a difference. We didn't look so much at technical problems, as you and Jonathan have discussed in an earlier program, but just the potential of people to be in an economic position and wanting the added value of having a radio that could receive this programming.
With this new figure for the potential audience for WorldSpace, do you think the system could ever be profitable?
We're not in a position really to answer that question, but in the paper, we're very doubtful that there will be enough radio sold quickly enough to make the service viable as a radio broadcasting medium. The question is, how long will the broadcasters stay on the system with such a small audience?
Doug Boyd knows the Middle East very well, traveling in the region several times a year.
These radios are for sale, for example, in the United Arab Emirates. But there, the main attraction not only is the internet and computing, but satellite television is the attraction. And the fact that the radios cannot be used in cars, where a lot of radio listening takes place, is another huge problem for WorldSpace technology.
So how long do you think it will take before the main objective of the WorldSpace system will be data transmission away from radio transmissions?
That depends on their business plan. I'm hesitant to use the word secretive, but they've been an organization now in existence for about 10 years that has never really been forthcoming with ownership until lately and their business plan. What they're working on is unknown, but they were established as a radio broadcaster from satellites.
The second satellite for Asia went up in March. A third for Latin America is in preparation.
Boyd notes that the projections for the cost of the receivers has gone up over the years. Back in 1995, WorldSpace made this promise.
In our coverage area in particular, receiver costs must start at a much lower threshold than what we believe is tolerable in OECD countries. This is an obvious fact, but certainly a necessary fact to the success of our business. Programming needs to follow if any of these receivers are to sell. One guilder is too much money for a receiver that has none or bad programming. We are developing a radio which will have a basic cost, hopefully, of about $50. That is a manufacturer's cost. We may even consider subsidizing part of this cost to ensure that the usual three or four times the cost of, from manufacture to retail isn't prohibitive to some of the people within our coverage area.
But what about now?
We calculated that the average cost of these radios is going to be about $300. And in our paper, we were very, very conservative. We tried to err on the side of WorldSpace. And one of the interesting things, if one looks at the history of WorldSpace's public announcements, starting from the mid-1990s, is that the radios progressively got expensive. And this is part of the history we've established in the paper. People were talking about sort of $50 radios and then $100 radios, and then they went to $200. And when the radios were rather publicly displayed in Washington, just before the satellite service that we studied became operational, they were in the $300 to $350 range. Looking at the history of technology and what has happened to the prices of VCRs and TV sets and things like that over the years, it takes a rather large market for the manufacturing costs to come down. If the radios were $50 to $100, it would be a different matter. But we looked in the neighborhood of $300.
And we'll keep watching the WorldSpace saga. We were talking there to Doug Boyd.
Award-winning Radio Netherlands, putting features first.
Keith Jarvis of Shrout in Gloucester in the UK is a new listener to the show via both medium wave, 1512 kHz, and appears to be browsing the Media Network website archive. That's where you can check out the show for up to 3 months after its broadcast. Keith says he's seen some statistics showing that Scandinavian countries are ahead when it comes to acceptance of the internet. But how does Holland measure up?
Well, Proactive, a Dutch market research company, recently measured the use of internet among people in the Netherlands. Almost half of the Dutch now claim to be familiar with internet, and that's a remarkable growth, bearing in mind that in the first quarter of last year, not even 30% of this country had ever been on the internet. Nowadays, 22% of the people use internet on a daily basis, compared to just 13% in January of last year. In real figures, that means 2.7 million people use internet daily. 36% of the Dutch population has access to the internet, a figure that's only beaten by Scandinavian countries and Switzerland.
Despite recent dips on the stock exchange, the new economy is turning into a lake awash with dot-coms. Companies that don't want to be swept away must be big and strong, and in particular, they must have sufficient capital. Still, the Dutch government doesn't believe things are moving fast enough, and back in the last week of April, politicians gave the starting signal for a number of combined initiatives to promote the use of the information and communication technology in the Netherlands. In a country with more than its fair share of banks and insurance companies, it's still surprising how slow some of these corporations are adapting to electronic transactions. That is why the government is going to spend $3 million on a publicity campaign to persuade the small and medium-sized enterprises that electronic commerce is the only way to go. 20% of these firms are doing so already. Another 14% think they might. And a staggering 56% remain unconvinced that money can be made in the midterm. The government is going to spend much more on equipping schools in Holland with modern computer training. And that will cost taxpayers $800 million to launch the project.
Media Network, crafted in our sun-drenched offices, balanced by the latest digital technology, beamed through space by geostationary satellites, and occasionally destroyed by the ionosphere. Oh well, it's not a perfect world.
Jude Kirkham sends us a response from Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada. Jude writes, I have long enjoyed listening to Media Network via the overnight service of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, although it's periodically preempted by other events of presumably greater importance to Canada, the thoroughly underwhelming millennium celebrations being the classic example. Shortwave reception here is inexplicably horrible for me, and my 14.4 kiloboard modem is more suited to email than real audio. But be that as it may, I was very interested in your report on video compact discs on a recent Media Network. They certainly are of much greater importance in the East than the West, but here in Vancouver, British Columbia, they're surprisingly widespread. This is due to the fascinating process of reverse assimilation that's going on, wherein ethnic Chinese are now a larger demographic than the European group. At the risk of boasting, I have to say it's a wonderful success story of our policy of multiculturalism. I know that DVDs are all the rage at the moment, but one should step back and remember that the high costs associated with the technology render it inaccessible to the majority of the population, even in a developed country. I use VCDs for viewing Japanese animation, a much belittled form of art that deserves more serious recognition. I found that the VCDs can easily contain 3 25-minute episodes with negligible picture deterioration. Anyway, please keep up the good work, and I look forward to further stories on the upcoming release of the PlayStation 2.
Well, Jude, as we've been finding out from Bob Tomolsky, some of the DVD players coming out of China at the moment are capable of playing CDs from all 6 of the official copyright regions. Normally, a DVD bought in Region 1, in other words, North America, will only play on a Region 1 player. Now, Bob has recently returned from a trip to a factory in the Pearl River Delta, in the technology triangle that includes Hong Kong and Guangzhou in China. There he discovered players with even more regions.
During the tour of the Miko factory, Bob played with a production sample of a DVD player. He discovered that by pressing 77 on the front panel, the player suddenly displayed a hidden menu allowing you to change the region code.
And the region code is very interesting. Of course, you've got region codes 1 through to 6, which are the normal region codes throughout, you know, the world. But you've also got some unusual region codes which were never used. There was going to be a region code of 7 and 8 for use on oil rigs, or use in prisons and use in coaches. In other words, these were going to be DVDs that would be manufactured for viewing to a limited public. And those region codes were planned but never instituted, but they're there in the chipset of these players. And also, and this is where it gets really naughty, you can switch off macro vision. So in other words, if you go into the menu, select that option, you can make a perfect copy from the DVD player to a VHS recorder, and macro vision isn't enabled. I've said to the Chinese, well, look, aren't you going to get into trouble over that? And they said, look, it's nothing to do with us. The chipset inside the machine comes from C-Cube, which is an American company, and those options are built into the C-Cube menu structure. And for us to remove those options would be a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of money. And frankly, we're not going to do that. If they're built into the chipset, so be it.
Bob Tomolsky. Now, news about the Grunning satellite 800 at the Funkausstellung back in 1995. The research team in Grunning, Germany, showed off the successor to the Grunning satellite 700. It was going to be the satellite 900, and it was going to be much better. But shortly afterwards, Grunning disbanded their shortwave radio research team in Europe. A couple of years passed, and Grunning North America announced the 900 wasn't dead, but that a vital chip had been discontinued, so a redesign was necessary. It's been 3 years since the announcement of that new receiver. In the meantime, the model number has become the satellite 800, and the radio has apparently been co-engineered with the US manufacturer of R.L. Drake. After a number of engineering-induced delays, the finished product finally began shipping to American dealers at the end of the first quarter of this year. The bottom line, though, is that quantities are shipping in such small orders that we haven't been able to get hold of a unit for review yet. But we have put one on order, it just hasn't yet turned up. And that's it for now from Deanna and myself.
Have a pleasant weekend.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static. Some people get far off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.